I remember the memory of his face. The complete shame that I, unintentionally, but I shamed him with the very best of intentions. He sat on the floor with his back against the wall, and he just suddenly seemed to get so small, and I saw that. I say that Parker came out of his closet, I went into mine.
Yeah.
But I prayed that gay away. I burned the sage. I prayed over his room, in his room. I had absorbed this idea that homosexuality and suicide were the ultimate offenses to God. And if I accepted my son, that made me a sinner too. I was frozen in that fear, and I was clinging to my faith, but it was killing me because I could not reconcile with that. The time lost is what haunts me the most. I missed an entire adolescence, and talking through this many times with therapists and with Parker is that I am his mother, but I wasn't there for him when he had to check himself at the door. In his own home, in our place of worship, at a school.
She founded a worldwide movement in support of the LGBTQ+ community. But before free mom hugs, before the parades and movie deal, she was a mom caught between what she'd been taught and who her son really was. This is part one of a two-part conversation with Sarah Cunningham. It's the part of the story where fear delays love, where doing what seemed right led to pain, distance, and years that can never be recovered. In part two, we'll see how she took that loss and built something beautiful from it. I'm Jeff Click, and this is Love Without Asterisks. Here is part one of my conversation with Sarah Cunningham.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to join me. I'm calling these first episodes foundational episodes.
Oh, I love that.
And the idea behind that is that we're leaning on the story that my wife and I went through as parents of an LGBTQ daughter. And I'm bringing in people who had an impact on that story to be my foundational episodes on this. And you were one of them. And so I reached out to you, and you were enthusiastic about the idea of doing this. And so I'm grateful for that, and I do appreciate you being here. So let's start, because we have so much in common. First of all, we both raised our kids in the capital city of the reddest state in the country.
What were we thinking?
Yeah, especially given what we know now and what we've gone through. So. Fill my audience in. Tell me a little bit about where you started, you know, as a parent, as your son comes into the picture. I know you have two children.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of inform us on that.
Yeah. Growing up, born and raised here in Oklahoma City, I wasn't a regular church goer. I went with the other neighborhood kids were going, and that was fine. But once my husband and I started a family of our own, I thought I need to probably get serious about this. I wanted to. So our oldest son went to VBS at a church near our home, and we just got plugged in. And we were there every time the church doors were open. And I loved church life. I loved learning about the scriptures and the fellowship of believers and raising my children and having a faith-based home.
What did love look like in the home at the time?
I think very traditional. You know, my husband worked. I stayed home with the children. That's fine with me. I preferred that.
Yeah. No, that's very similar to our story. In fact, I came from a very evangelical Southern Baptist background. Was raised, in a family like you were mm-hmm. describing, in church on Sundays, usually twice. When youth group kind of came into the picture, it was Wednesday nights. My wife, on the other hand, Desiree, you know, I grew up in the same house from 3 years old all the way through college. And so, like, kind of this steady consistency was a thread within my life. With her, You know, her family followed oil work throughout Oklahoma and Texas. So, you know, the last time we counted, it was over 24 times that she moved through her young life. And her, you know, her her move into more of the religious aspect of her life was, there were Southern Baptist churches in the small towns where she ended up that would commonly send buses around to bring kids back to church, right? And so her exposure to church life really came from that. And as our relationship started moving towards marriage, we too kind of made the commitment that, hey, we want to raise our kids in a Christian environment, Christian household. And so we too plugged into a church where we heavily invested our lives and spent, you know, 20 years volunteering there, going there, and raising our kids there. And so certainly that contributed to what I call a worldview shaped by tradition.
Absolutely.
And when I use that term, you know, that for that can mean something different for everyone, but it, for us, it usually, you know, integrates our religion and even our political views at the time, as kind of a conservative worldview that really shaped our approach towards everything, but relevant here, parenthood. So talk to me about when you started to see things shift. As your son Parker grew older, obviously you started perhaps seeing things that may have conflicted or caused tension with the religious and more conservative side.
Yes. And I love that we do share the commonality of growing up very, we just absorbed what we grew up with. Like, I was raised never to question authority or never to talk about money or sex. And honestly, that's how we got into this mess, I believe. And I just was in this bubble with my family and this congregation and feeling very secure, not only in our salvation, but in the way that we were raising our children. And you mentioned political biases that, you know, I remember a pastor suggesting that we vote for a president because they're friends of Israel. And that's what I did. You see, I didn't question what was being preached from the pulpit or Sunday school class and all that. When I started seeing Parker, I remember the very first aha moment. He was 5 years old. I was in the kitchen. He was upstairs. He came barreling down the stairs in one of my dresses and a pair of my heels. And he danced in that kitchen until his hair was wet with sweat. And I had never seen that expression on him before. He was five.
Yeah.
And that was my first, like, he's enjoying that a lot. And our oldest son was just like, not having it, you know? So from then on, it was not allowing a real space for the conversations to happen or even for him to express himself through himself.
Right.
It was
so
always,
you saw signs of this early on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was always a compromise. He always gravitated towards more feminine things, pink, sparkly, Barbie type things. And it was always a compromise.
So was this creating tension for you at home?
Absolutely.
And then your husband, Rex, how is he processing through this at the time?
He has a brother who's gay and cousins who are gay. So he was a little more sympathetic. And but I certainly spearheaded, you know, the way we shopped for our children, how they dressed and how they behaved. I was definitely the stronger one in that way.
Right. So when did that, so that was the first instance. Talk about when that started to become a bit more present and real and creating tension perhaps with your faith. At what age were you starting to see those kinds of
things? I remember, and this is when I get emotional, because I remember when Parker was about 15, it was late at night. Everybody else was asleep and it was just, he and I was doing laundry and he was, I don't know, still up. He would stay up all night if you let him. And he tried to have that conversation with me, in the living room of our home. And he said, Mom, I think I'm gay. And I said, what makes you think that? And I just manipulated the conversation. I said, but just get through school. You know, everybody in your school thinks they're gay right now. I thought it was just a phase or some wanting attention or something. And I just did not allow him that conversation at all. And that was the night that, in fact, it was titled, the title of my book is How We Sleep at Night. Mm. And I don't know how he got to bed to sleep that night.
Given how the conversation went.
Yeah. And the reason why I get emotional, and I want to share this, but is I remember the memory of his face, the complete shame that I unintentionally, but I shamed him with the very best of intentions. But I remember he sat on the floor with his back against the wall, and he just suddenly seemed to get so small. And I saw that, but I was too wrapped up in my idea of homosexuality. And I can't forget that.
Yeah. It's interesting how those moments tend to burn their way into our minds, because that lands with me. I remember crazy distinct details about the moment I had the conversation, or my daughter instigated the conversation with me and came out to me. I remember where we were standing. I remember.
You feel comfortable sharing that?
Yeah. What the day, I remember what the day felt like. And yeah, it's just, in looking back on it, it is so interesting how these things can impact us in ways that we can never forget. And so clearly this created what I'm going to call perhaps a wedge, or it drops something,
a huge divide
right into the living room. When it comes to, I know for me, my identity, I mean, it's strange. And in looking back on it, a lot of my reaction had to do with me. And a lot of my reaction had to do with, what am I going to do with this? And what are people in my world and my circles going to think about me as the parent? And I think that's a human response.
Absolutely.
For some of us who think that way. I found that people, I found that people in our position process this differently. They're perhaps in one or more ways of like identity sensitivity, or the emotionality of it, or perhaps I need some rational argument about where I'm going to land on this. Mm-hmm. We need to talk through scripture. We need to talk through politics. All the things that sort of, in my experience, it felt like the volume started to turn up on those things. And I think it was because they were playing in my head and screaming at me on, how are you going to reconcile this? Mm-hmm. So tell me about your experience on those terms. What was going through your mind as you wrestled through that?
Complete and utter panic. First and foremost, I worried about Parker's safety. At this time, we're hearing about the Matthew Shepard story and his, what happened in the life and death of Matthew Shepard just changed the way America handles and talks about hate crimes. And that was first and foremost. And beyond that, and even bigger than that, was his salvation. I had absorbed this idea that homosexuality and suicide were the ultimate offenses to God and the doctrine that we served. And if I accepted my son, that made me a sinner too. Mm-hmm. And so I was frozen in that fear, and I was clinging to my faith, but it was killing me because I could not reconcile with that. I didn't know where to look for resources. The very next morning, I'm sure I looked up things like, now they call it conversion therapy or shame-based ministry, any type of therapy practice or prayer that would try to change a person's gender identity, sexual orientation, which
known as praying the gay away, basically.
Exactly. Yes. And by this time, they're finding out how dangerous that is. So that wasn't an option. Plus, he was just 15 at the time, so he wasn't even old enough. So, and I didn't know any other mothers like me at the time. And I just didn't even know where to look for resources. I went to Barnes & Noble and looked for resources. And there was a book that a woman wrote, a mother wrote, that she had two daughters and that one daughter died in a horrible car accident and the other came out as a lesbian. And the mother wrote that it was easier to accept her daughter dying in the accident than it was for her daughter. And that was not helpful at all. And so when I say that Parker came out of his closet, I went into mine.
Yeah.
But I prayed that gay away. I burned the sage. I prayed over his room, in his room. I cleaned out anything that, you know, like he had poems and drawings and, you know, just anything that I thought would be any type of inclination or any type of risque towards that, towards homosexuality, I threw it out.
Yeah.
And I tried to confide with people within our church. And we really did not know how to minister to each other, because when I heard love the sinner, hate the sin, that was the worst thing you can say to someone.
I've come to that same conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels differently when you're on the other side of it and you're the one hearing it from people.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to add too that good intentioned friends that I had known for 20 years. Well, by the time Parker, when he turned 21, he met someone. Mm-hmm. And so that's when the real alienation began within the church and the congregation.
Because he was more out, so to speak.
Yeah, he definitely took a stand as a gay man.
The friends topic is something that I've processed through. And it was probably one of the more difficult things for me because, again, identity sensitive. What are my friends going to think? Professionally, how is this going to look on me? You know, career-wise, I had kind of branded myself and wrapped my marketing in faith-based language. Mm-hmm. And I felt like here I am now at a moment in my life where something beyond my control has now caused me to perhaps look hypocritical, or it's not consistent with who I've claimed to be. And that alone was challenging. Trying to find somebody to talk to was, it felt like silence. And what I've come to realize and understand, and perhaps you've come to this conclusion too, is that, you know, in those circles, when we're so heavily embedded within a conservative community, a Christian community, especially evangelical, we expect our friends to somehow have the language to support us in this situation when they don't, you know? I struggled a lot with disappointment, with the feeling of loneliness, with no way to verbally process through this with really anybody but my wife, who was dealing with it in her own terms. Mm-hmm. And that was a real challenge for me. You know, interestingly enough, about this podcast, one of the first things I did was search for a podcast for parents, for Christian parents of LGBTQ kids, and nothing came up. And I found a few episodes of other podcasts that might touch on the topic. Mm-hmm. It's how I discovered David P. Gushy.
Yes.
Who has been a remarkable resource and guide for me in this process. But I've had to come to kind of realize that, you know, I my feeling of loneliness and disappointment, perhaps while valid, was maybe misdirected at friends that didn't deserve it, simply because they just, I mean, here we expect them to be on this road with us when we're the ones that are already, you know, 50 steps down the road, mm-hmm. and they have no reason to travel this road. So, you know, expecting friends to be able to come to the rescue in that situation is a little tough in our circles, right?
Right. I was devastated at first, just devastated and then disillusioned. And then there came a time when I thought, you know, we didn't know how to talk to each other about it.
And we being who in this case?
The friendships that I've made throughout the 20 years serving in the church. And what you said about, you know, thinking about how, number one, I thought if I accepted Parker, not even mentioning celebrate him, that that made me just as much as a sinner. And then
what made you conclude that, or at the time, what do you think was contributing to that perspective?
Bad theology.
Okay.
Bad theology.
I call that our blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
The blueprint we've been handed.
Yes.
What we've been raised to think or have been taught to think.
Yeah. Gosh.
And to your earlier point, authority we've given to others and teaching us, and
we didn't question
accepting it without question. Right.
Right.
You know, I've been doing a lot of writing for this project, and you've had the opportunity to read through
Don't
some
stop.
Of those. Thank you. One that I've been working on recently is about, there's this account I follow on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with this, but I'm going to make it about this. But it's an account that shows clips of wildlife, right? And wildlife in all of its splendor and all of its glory, but also all of the horrific things that happen in nature,
yeah.
Right? Animals doing their thing in the wild. And if you follow accounts like that, there's kind of a theme you see in some of these videos where, you know, you see the helpless offspring of perhaps it could even be an offspring of a fierce species, but the offspring and the youngness of this animal makes it susceptible and vulnerable. And you see either jackals or a pride of lions, you know what's about to happen, right? And they've got their eye on this easy hunt. And then out of nowhere, the mom of this animal comes into frame and just goes berserk, stomping, kicking, all the things that, you know, an animal of this type is, that's really all they can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's their attempt to come to the rescue of their child. But in doing so, if you've seen enough of these videos, often you see some tragic things happen where the mom ends up doing more damage to the child than the jackals or the pride around it. And I wonder if that lands with you at all, because to me, I see a little bit of that, how easily that can happen in a situation like this.
Absolutely. Yes. I did some real damage, and I said some things and I acted in ways that I regret even today. And I get emotional about it, and we've worked through some things, but I don't know if we'll ever, I mean, it's been really hard. Like I say that it's just been difficult, and I'm so fortunate that I have him and we're able to talk through so many things. But even as we age and we deconstruct and then reconstruct, and then something will come up. And I mean, really, even in the work of Free Mom Hawks, it still brings that back around. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, either it reminds you of it, or you see similar situations, or other people making mistakes that you know better than now.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would love to hear from you about like lost time. I mean, from the time he came out to the time perhaps that you started coming around, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
How long was that, would you say?
Well, the living room conversation, he was 15. And from 15 to 21, I just manipulated the conversation or didn't talk about it, complete denial. You know, I just took his spiritual temperature throughout that whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had lunch one day and he said, "Mom, I met someone and I need you to be okay about it." And that's the day that I faced reality. And I wanted to put a big old banner on the front of our house saying, "Welcome to the real world."
Mm-hmm. So that was your pivot point?
Yes, it was. And one of many.
Yeah.
One of many.
Yeah.
But the time lost is what haunts me the most. I missed an entire adolescence. And talking through this many times with therapists and with Parker is that I am his mother. But I wasn't there for him when he had to check himself at the door in his own home, in our place of worship, at a school. Thank God for teachers that were there that were affirming. Not all of them. Some of them were pretty hard on him.
Yeah.
But he had a couple that were a safe space. And I can never get that time back. Never. And I know parents who have lost their children either by complete no contact or by death.
So we can derive from that that you would advocate for early action.
Absolutely.
Not delaying. Because, and this is something I've spent a lot of time writing about. I call it return on inclusion rather yes. than return on investment. But I use the metaphor of investment in the in how, you know, the best time to invest was in the past.
Yes.
Because, you know,
trust me,
the returns, yeah. you know, you gain bigger returns later and sooner because of that. Or even the old Chinese proverb that, you know, the best time to have planted a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to advocate to my audience who might be in our situation that early action is important. Presence over perfection will yield greater results than trying to put this off until you know it's a train that you're going to have to face coming down the tracks. Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah.
That my audience might want to hear from you about?
If you're a parent, a sibling, or anyone in your life, whether they're 7 or 77, when they share the most intimate parts of who they are with you, when they show you who they are, even if it's on a journey of self-discovery, believe them. And parents ask me, what can I do? What should I do? All the time. And I say, well, you find a way to celebrate your child and accept your child, or you'll find a way to live without them. Mm. Because there were pivotal moments in this walk. And the first one of many was Parker said, Mom, I have sucked it up for 21 years being your son. I need you to suck it up now and be my mom. And that got me out of bed. And then he said, another time was, Mom, I want you in every area of my life, but how much of that is up to you? And that put me in check. And then seeing him happy and healthy and with people that would accept him and celebrate him when I was still kind of on the fence, you see?
Yeah.
All those things just put me in check.
It's a very easy is not the right word. I think it's a human response as a parent in that situation to think, let's give this time. Let's see where this lands. Maybe this is a phase, or maybe this is a work in progress. So let's not invest just yet in doing the work.
Yeah.
Because maybe this will change. Hopefully this will change in some people's minds, right? I wonder what other things we're missing in that scenario, because one of the things I've spent a lot of time thinking about is, you mentioned friends. I also think about our child's identity, because it's still forming. Just because they've yes. come out doesn't mean that suddenly, boom, we're blossomed and we're now what we are, right? Mm-hmm. It's a continuum. It's a journey. And in hindsight, my wife Desiree and I have talked a lot about this, where delaying involvement in this process is essentially checking out of the parental role in the formation of your child's identity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to me, it makes a lot more sense, even though it doesn't in the moment, in hindsight, the importance of being present as that identity forms versus not being there are huge differences.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an easy pitfall that parents or friends or family members of, you know, whoever may be supporting an LGBTQ someone, that standoffishness and that silence still says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What have you found to be the case in just in the people you know? And obviously you've seen this story play out hundreds yes. of times.
Well, the silence is alienating. It alienates you. And whether you can see it at the time or not, it's happening. And what I like to say about that journey of self-discovery is this, is that the acronym? I don't always understand it. The L and the G and the B and the T and the Q and the I and the two spirit and beyond. I think, I hope one day we don't even need it. But right now, the beautiful thing about the acronym is that as a person is on their journey of self-discovery, they can look at those letters, the L and the G and the B and the T and beyond, and look at those definitions, and it allows a vocabulary to express, to talk about it, and to identify like that, that's how I feel. That's me. And that's a powerful thing to be able to be on that journey of self-discovery. I also learned late in life the difference between gender identity and sexual orientation. Who knew? I mean, really, I was really in a place of fear and ignorance. And I have been in both rooms, fear and ignorance. I know the power, and I know the power of love and education. Fear and ignorance keeps you frozen. And as far as like gender identity and sexual orientation, sexual identity is, do you feel like a boy? Do you feel like a girl? Do you feel like both or neither one? Everyone has a gender identity. Sexual orientation, much the same as who do you want to be with? A boy? Do you want to be with a girl? Do you want to be with both or neither one? This is the essence of human sexuality that we were dumbed down and
told there was only one
way. Not to talk about it. But love and education brings about knowledge of this beautiful essence of humanity. And to be able to see that in you and in me and in our children, it's not perverted. It's not dirty. It's a gift from God to be celebrated. And what a gift our children bring to our families, to the world around us with their identity and orientation. Because our generation, of course, mine especially, we were duped.
Yeah. I agree. Back to Friends. When Parker was starting to associate with people that he felt like he belonged with, Did you find that threatening? Did you find that intimidating? What were thoughts that went through your mind on that?
There were fellow students that also identified in the respectfully gay community. There were a few in our youth group, but I just thought they might have influenced each other.
Mm.
But now I know these beautiful adults now, and that's something I feel bad about too.
That's a thing that to think that, you know, my child wasn't like this until they started hanging out with those people. That's an easy off-ramp to explain something, right? What we came to understand is that perhaps there's an alternative explanation for what's happening here. Because again, our daughter, evangelical. Everyone around us, we were part of this circle. We were, you know, epicenter of it.
Mm-hmm.
Geopolitically, also just the way we had kind of designed our life, the blueprint of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And what I now understand was happening was our daughter was gravitating towards people that she felt like understood her,
mm-hmm.
that she felt like had a grasp of what this whole identity situation meant, even though her parents perhaps didn't at the time. And you know, when I see examples of parents who are restricting their kids from hanging out with people they identify with in that regard, I mean, you can leap to all these conclusions about, oh, well, it's getting them into this or it's normalizing them to that. And, you know, every parent needs to make responsible decisions about their children, obviously. But I would encourage my audience in this situation to carefully consider what it might cost their child if they're being restricted from others that they can identify with, that they can feel like they belong with, who they can relate with, who they can talk with. Because man, the alternative to that is we're really giving our kids no option.
No.
And it's no wonder the statistics start to skew very dramatically once that enters the picture. You know, in your work, you would know just as well as anyone. I know with Desiree, as a psychiatric PA, you know, sees this every day in her office. Just how impactful and the weight of silence or unacceptance. I mean, there's even dramatic statistical changes when one parent is accepting or affirming of their child than if zero are. I mean, it essentially can cut certain risks in half or more, you know, by having that one person in their life who, you know, sees them for who they are. And that's, you know, those kinds of statistics and those kinds of realities are things that I'm hoping to bring to the surface here for those who are really searching mm-hmm. for information like that. Because I mentioned earlier, you know, one of the first places I started was searching for a podcast. I was like, man, give me something I can have on in the car that nobody's going to hear, that, you know, I can privately process through this and maybe gain.
Were you just desperate for something?
Absolutely. I was. Yeah. And it was so lonely. And yeah, again, that's just where some of those feelings of disappointment and not having anyone to process through with really started to wreak havoc on me. And I had to find a way to work through this.
Yeah, me too.
So let's fast forward to 2015.
Watch out.
This is a big year for you.
I want to go back.
You want to skip? Okay. Yeah.
But two things. One is talking about friends, relationships with the kids, youth. But I want to talk about teachers for a moment because at that time I wanted to be in the world, not of it. You church folk will know that language, yeah. You know, but I thought the few teachers that were out at Parker School were safe spaces for him. I knew he could go to their classrooms if he had any trouble or whatever. He probably confided with them, you know, maybe about life at home. And at the time, I resented that.
Yeah.
But now I really do believe that they quite possibly could have saved a life.
Maybe I agree with that.
And so I want parents to understand what's going on now, especially in Oklahoma with our gay and transgender youth in public schools. I'm so thankful that Parker had those teachers.
They're lifelines.
Yes.
And I understand, Desiree and I have talked about this, where someone kind of enters the picture and they seem to be a potential threat to the parental dynamic here.
Yeah.
I don't want another adult telling my child the opposite of what I'm telling her, right? When in fact, that adult in their life may be the one who's actually helping them feel seen, helping them feel understood. And the other thing too, we found was that, you know, depending upon the situation and who this person is, we have found that if you show up as the parent, as the adult, with a genuine interest and your child to these adults.
Yes.
They may be some of your greatest resources on how to get some understanding of what's going on with your child.
Exactly.
Right? Because they're seeing them in a context you don't see them, with language that you don't have, with life experience and understanding that we don't have. And if it's at school, they're getting to see what the child's going through at school, which we don't get to see. And so we just were, like you, very thankful for the adults who ended up stepping up in her life to provide sort of some auxiliary support in ways that, looking back,
so if you're like, out there and a parent, I mean, what I thought of those teachers at the time was not good. But today I'm telling you, I'm so incredibly thankful that they were there.
Yeah.
And how important it is for teachers to be their authentic selves in the workplace.
Sure. And I think there's an important point to make here to the audience as well, because not everybody here listening or watching is necessarily a parent of an LGBTQ someone.
Right.
My hope is that this can cast a broad net for anyone looking for ways to kind of reconcile what we're talking about here, faith, culture, politics, with the person that they love and that they're trying to support. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that there are people out there who could be those teachers, who could be the adult, the friend, the aunt, the someone who has done the work or has had the experiences, as David Gushee calls it, you know, the transformative encounter, mm-hmm. which is something that you and I've had. But there is such a need for people to make it known that they are allies and that they are available. We just the other night, Desiree and I were talking about, word had gotten around to me that someone in our previous circles had made the comment that Jeff Click had gone woke. And, you know, I started thinking through that. I was like, well, do they have a point? How, you know, can they be right about this? Am I woke? Because clearly I've taken a different path, or I've reached different conclusions than the old version of myself would have based on what I knew back then and the circles I ran with. And it's really easy to say, oh, well, Jeff left the flock, if we're using religious language. He's stepped away from his faith and gone woke. But man, there is so much space in between where I was and wokeness. There's so much space here to stand and to exist in. And I think maybe my identity-sensitive past self only saw that as a binary thing. You're either with us or against us. And I want to at least shine some light on the possibility that there's a lot of space in between being, you know, very religious or committed to a certain understanding of scripture and being so far left, right? There's a lot of room in there. And what I'm hoping to do is help people to kind of inch out of this bubble of belief and this bubble of the way that they view the world, and in this case, view LGBTQ, mm-hmm. you know, people and the entire discussion, to point out there's a lot of room between that. And just because you may not find me at the same church I went to for 20 years, just because you don't find me there on Sunday anymore, just because you don't find me with certain preset radio stations in my car, just because you don't find me overtly identifying myself as a Christian, doesn't mean that the opposite is true.
Yeah.
It just means that I, and my wife included, we have chosen to stand in a different place. Mm-hmm. And that's with our daughter. Because if we're not doing it, you know, I mean, I just can't imagine not standing with her. And we've had a number of experiences that I call those trench moments, where whatever Bible verse, whatever political talking point, you know, it's a real easy off-ramp for people to say that and then go along with their lives. But those of us in this situation have to live beyond those thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to reconcile, what does life look like with those beliefs, or how do we adjust those beliefs in order to reconcile and fully love our someone? Mm-hmm. I don't know that there's a question there, but does that bring anything to the surface for you?
Yeah, it reminds me of a couple of things early on in my accidental advocacy. Is that as I began to understand and grow in my knowledge and love and get educated, now understanding that there's so many resources out there that no matter where you stand, historically, scientifically, scripturally, biblically, to not have a better understanding, that really the only choice is to remain in fear and ignorance.
Yeah.
That's the only choice. Now, we hope to be that bridge because we've been in both rooms, right? There was a time that I thought I wanted to build that bridge. And I hope you will. I believe that you are with what you're doing. But I tried a lot of different projects before Free Mom Hugs came about. I had a project I called Together at the Table. I would prepare a meal in my home. I would put some tables together like the Lord's Supper. And I invited 20 years worth of relationships that I've had in youth pastors and senior pastors, elders, women, scholars, theologians. I would invite them to the table with this newfound resources that I was finding from Bible scholars, theologians like
Gushy and Matthew Vines.
And I would have those resources available. And I would also invite the pastors, the gay pastors who are pastoring fully affirming churches, the allies, members of the transgender community that I was meeting. I would invite them to the table in hopes to just have that conversation so they could share themselves and maybe glean something just to bridge that gap. I couldn't get anybody to the table for my 20 years. Or if they did come to the table, it was just to be cordial. Did they take the resources? No. Did they take the faith-based resources from scholars and theologians? No.
Yeah.
They just weren't interested. And I was defeated. I felt like I was trying to make something happen. It didn't work.
While her delay came at a cost, what I love about Sarah's story is that she didn't just stay there. She turned her pain into something alive, where the simple power of a hug spoke louder than shame ever could. What began as heartbreak became a global embrace that reminds us what's possible when love finally shows up. Next time, you'll see how she built Free Mom Hugs, an organization that empowers the world to celebrate the LGBT plus community, restores visibility and hope, and shows what happens when love is put into action. If you want to learn more or get involved, visit freemomhugs.org. You can also follow Free Mom Hugs on all the socials. All the links you're after are available in the show notes. And don't miss Sarah's book, How We Sleep at Night, her firsthand account of the journey we just heard, available on Amazon. If you're new here, welcome. You can watch full episodes on YouTube or listen wherever you get your podcasts. I'd be grateful if you'd help spread the word. When you subscribe, like, and share, it helps these conversations reach the people who need them most. Did this episode speak to you? Did it move you in ways that were helpful or hopeful? I'm already hearing from listeners who are finding pieces of their own story in these conversations, and I'd love to hear from you too. Email me at jeff@lovewoa.com. And if this podcast is landing with you and you want to dig deeper in between episodes, check out Metamorphosis, my free multi-week email series. It's a guided path toward a more affirming love, using our family's story to explore the cracks that appear when old blueprints meet real life, and how love becomes the renovation that holds. We'll touch on friendship, faith, and affirmation, and you'll learn to separate the voice of love from the noise of fear. Discover what it means to show up with presence instead of perfection by subscribing at lovewoa.com. This has been Love Without Asterisks, Episode 2, Part 1. If Part 1 was the reckoning, Part 2 is the redemption. It's where love opens its arms, steps forward, and becomes contagious. I hope you'll join us for that. Until then, I'm Jeff Click, reminding you that the greatest of these is love.